The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Well, my name is Charles Fuller. I have the privilege of introducing, and this is moderating this panel, introducing the wonderful people on this panel, and also moderating. We are waiting for Sonia Sanchez, who I've been told is in traffic. So when she comes, she will come immediately to the stage. I'd just like to introduce you to the people who are here, Brother Amiri Baraka and Brother Ed Bullens. I'm going to read a short introduction. It's Mr. Amiri Baraka, poet, playwright, political activist, is the author of over 40 books of essays, poems, drama, and music history and criticism. He's been a revolutionary political activist who has recited poetry and lecture on culture and political issues extensively in the USA, the Caribbean, Africa, and Europe. With influences on his work ranging from music, orishas such as Ornette Coleman, John Coltrane, Thelonious Monk, and Sun Ra, to the Cuban Revolution, Malcolm X, and world revolutionary movements, Mr. Baraka is renowned as the founder of the Black Arts Movement in Harlem in the 1960s, a movement that became the blueprint for a new American theater aesthetics. He's published in performance works such as his study of the African-American music, Blues People, and the play Dutchman, seeded this cultural movement that spread across the United States and the world. The list of Mr. Baraka's work is far too long to read here, but I will turn your attention to selected poetry of Amiri Baraka Leroy Jones, 1979, The Music, 1987, a fascinating collection of poems and monographs on jazz and blues, authored by Mr. Baraka and his wife, poet Amina, and his boldly sortate essays, The Essence of Reparations. His controversial poem, Somebody Blew Up America, and other poems is Mr. Baraka's first collection of poems published in the Caribbean and led the governor of New Jersey, to call for Mr. Baraka's resignation as the state's poet laureate because of a few lines of the poem that ask, who knew beforehand about the New York City World Trade Center bombings in 2001? Mr. Baraka is a recipient of the Guggenheim Foundation and National Endowment for the Arts Fellowships, the James Weldon Johnson Medal for Contributions to the Arts, the Rockefeller Foundation Award for Drama, the Penn Faulkner Award, and Obie Award. He is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters, Professor Emeritus at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, and the past Poet Laureate of the State of New Jersey. He has taught at Yale, Columbia, and the State University of New York at Stony Brook. It has been said that Mr. Amiri Baraka has been committed to social justice like no other American writer. I give you the poet and writer, Amiri Baraka. Thank you. Now to Mr. Brother Ed Bullens. Mr. Ed Bullens has been a force in American theater for more than 35 years, and in my estimation is one of the finest playwrights we have ever produced. After a stint in the Navy, Mr. Bullens, a native Philadelphian, began his playwriting career in 1965 in San Francisco at the Firehouse Repertory Theater, where How Do You Do, Dialect Determinism, or The Rally, and Clara's Old Man were first performed. Clara's Old Man would win Mr. Bullens the Vernon Rice Drama Desk Award. In 1967, Mr. Bullens would begin a six-year association with Robert Macbeth and the New Lafayette Theater in New York, where he would create or produce nearly a dozen plays. From 1968 to 1991, Mr. Bullens would write The Corner, The Electronic Nigger, Gone to Buffalo, In the Wine Time, The Gentleman Caller, In New England Winter, The Duplex, The Fabulous Miss Marie, The Taking of Miss Janie, and Salam Huey Newton, Salam. I saw all these plays, but Salam Huey Newton, Salam, and I can assure you they are absolutely brilliant. He would win Obie Awards for Distinguished Playwriting for The Fabulous Miss Marie, and a New England winter. In 1969, Mr. Bullens would write, "We write as bombers under the name of Kingsley Bass." Mr. Bullens has been the recipient of 2 Guggenheim Fellowships, the New York Drama Critics Circle Award for The Taking of Miss Janie, a Rockefeller Foundation grant, an O'Delcott Award, and a National Endowment for the Arts Award in Playwriting. Originally published in 1971, The Hungered One is a collection of early short stories that explore loneliness, despair, and ambition. The New York Times Book Review wrote, "A richness of language and observation pervades this collection of short stories." In 1995, Mr. Bullens was appointed to be the professor of theater at Northeastern University. He is currently working on opening up the Roxbury Crosswords Theater in Boston, Massachusetts, where the theater will feature Mr. Bullens' newest play, Harlem Diva. It is said in the biography of Mr. Bullens that he has written over 100 plays, as one of the key figures along with Mr. Baraka in the Black Arts Movement of the 1960s. I give you Mr. Ed Bullens. I'm still looking for Sister Sonia. She's not arrived. But to keep on moving, the Black Arts Movement was a phenomenon of the 1960s. This movement, according to the poet and critic Larry Neal, was radically opposed to any concept of the artist that alienates him from his community. Black arts is the aesthetic and spiritual sister of the Black Power concept. As such, it envisions art that speaks directly to the needs and aspirations of Black America. I have a question, one I will put to Brother Baraka. As you are the acknowledged creator of the Black Arts Movement, looking back, what were the reasons that forced you to create the movement in the first place? And why was the Black Arts Movement considered a revolutionary movement?
Well, the Black Arts started actually downtown Greenwich Village. When Malcolm X was murdered, the bunch of us moved out of Greenwich Village because we thought that murder was the beginning of a war. They had just killed Kennedy a year and a half before that. And so when Malcolm X was murdered, we all moved to Harlem. I had some money from a play. I was putting on some plays, I think The Slave, The Baptism, something like that. So we rented a brownstone, and we sent 4 trucks a night, and the day and night, into Harlem community, one with music, one with graphic arts, one with poetry, poetry, drama, music, graphic arts. And we went to different places, parks, play streets, vacant lots. And we did that throughout the summer of 1965. And what we said we wanted to do was 3 things. First, we wanted an art that was Black, culturally. The Malcolm's murder had made us nationalists. When I was in the Village, people would come up to me and say, "Oh, Mr. Jones, I didn't know you were a Negro," and that would make me feel like I needed an enema or something like that, So we wanted to create art that was first Black, that had the cultural resonance of the Afro-American people. Second, we wanted to create an art that was not limited to little small, ambiguous dens of art and arting. We wanted to bring art into the street. We wanted the Afro-American people to grasp the most advanced art that they had created, because we thought that would help them with the third proposition, and the third proposition was liberation. We wanted to create an art that would help in the liberation of Black people openly, clearly, just like the SNCC or the Black Panthers or SCLC. We wanted an art that would help to destroy national oppression and racism. And so that's what we did, consciously set out and brought the most advanced artists we knew into Harlem to try to do that. And that spread to you know, throughout the country, to Woody King in Detroit, and Hakeem Adabudi in Chicago, and Marvin X and Ed Bullins in San Francisco, and Val Ferdinand in New Orleans. And so after that 1 year, it proliferated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mr. Bullins, you said in an interview, we who began in the black theater in the mid-60s and 70s felt like we were lending our energies, voices, artistic minds, and everything else to the struggle for physical liberation called the Civil Rights Movement, then the Black Power Movement. And so consequently, we felt like it was very important to do, and to do that, to achieve that, we had to raise the consciousness of the, for lack of a better word, the black masses. Was the Black Arts Movement a consciousness-raising movement, raising movement? And if it was, can you point to some of the changes today brought about by the consciousness raised during that period?
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. Before I answer your question, I'm going to give a few propers. Hello, Philadelphia. As a son of Philadelphia, born here, raised here, fought and left here, but returned many times, I am immensely happy to see some of my Bullins and Garrison Philly family and all the Philadelphians here today. I want to answer the question by reading a short piece, a paragraph of mine, which got me into some things. And it goes like this. It's from a play called it wasn't a play originally. It was a short story, vignette, a poetic idea. And it goes like this. She passed the corner in small ballerina slippers every evening during my last wine time, wearing a light summer dress with big pockets, swinging her head back and to the side all special-like, hearing a private melody singing in her head. Well, after I wrote that story, I got convinced that I would become a writer. I had promised myself that I would be a writer, but after finding work that I could do, I swore that I would become a writer. Now, I learned black lore and logic from way back, from North Philadelphia, from my mother who pointed out the Moorish Americans who sat on the corners, from Daddy Grace visits to other people of some consciousness. And by the time I entered college, Los Angeles, I and another group of brothers roomed with some people. And so by the time I got to San Francisco, I met Marvin Jackman, who became Marvin X. And we were both writing, and Marvin wrote a play called Flowers for the Trash Man. And I got a play, my first play, and which turned into my three plays, In the Wine Time, and Clara's Old Man and another play. And so consequently, I had big visions, and I tried to realize them. Now, going back to the beginnings of my writings that did not fail, I got some of the inspiration from Ron Coringa, who was a roommate of those people at that time, who was trying to build consciousness among the black community in Los Angeles. And from there I went to San Francisco, and there I went to worked with Marvin, and he and I founded a theater, Black Arts West, which was emanating from the work of Amiri Baraka. So that's how, that's how I come around, like they say.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine.
Woo! I think there's a game someplace on the expressway.
So I'll just end with what goes around comes around.
Let me welcome Sister Sonia Sanchez.
How you doing, my dear brother?
Is your sleep?
No, I did two things today already.
We're just reading something about her. Sister Sonia Sanchez's biography, we're told, that sometime during the late 1950s, she formed a writer's workshop in Greenwich Village, attended by such poets as Amiri Baraka, Akeem Mahubuti, Larry Neal, Nikki Giovanni, and Etheridge Knight. Just to form that kind of a group with that powerful group of poets must have been an extraordinary experience. It was during this time that she became involved with the Black Arts Movement and began a career as one of the most prolific African-American poets and playwrights. The idea was, and I quote from a discussion Ms. Sanchez had at the University of the Arts, the idea was to lift the words off the page to make them come alive in the mouths of the poets who wrote them. In 1965, she was in the San Francisco area, pioneering and developing black studies courses at San Francisco State University, where she was an instructor from 1968 to 1969. From that time to now, bringing us a world of fine art in the form of more than a dozen poetry, plays, and children's books. In 1969, she would publish Homecoming, followed by a long list of books of poetry. We Are Bad People, We Be Word Sorcerers, Homegirls and Hand Grenades, Under a Soprano Sky, A CD Sacred Ground, and Does Your House Have Lions, which incidentally is being performed by the University of Arts today at 7 p.m. and tomorrow at 2 p.m. What theater is that going to
be? Miriam.
At the Miriam Theater. Okay. If you get a chance, please get down there. Her most recent book is titled Wounded in the House of a Friend.
Mm-mm.
Is that it? No, that's not.
Shake Loose My Skin.
Oh, okay. Say that again.
Shake Loose My Skin.
Shake Loose My Skin, okay. Among the many honors Sister Sonia Sanchez has received are the Community Service Award from the National Book Caucus of State Legislatures, the Decretia Mott Award, the Outstanding Arts Awards for the Pennsylvania Coalition of 100 Black Women, the Peace and Freedom Award from Women International League for Peace and Freedom, the Pennsylvania Governor's Award for Excellence in Humanities, a National Endowment for the Arts Award, a Pew Fellowship in the Arts, and for her book, Homegirls and Hand Grenades, the 1985 American Book Award. Sonia Sanchez has lectured at more than 500 universities and colleges in the United States and has traveled extensively, reading her poetry in Africa, Cuba, England, the Caribbean, Australia, Nicaragua, the People's Republic of China, Norway, and Canada. She was the first presidential fellow at Temple University, where she began teaching in 1977 and held the Laurel Cornell Chair in English there until her retirement in 1999. I give you Sister Sonia Sanchez. Okay. Everyone is here now. Sister Sanchez, I've asked Brother Barack and Brother Bullens a question. I wanted to ask you one. I heard you say in an interview that one of the things you wanted to do was to lift the words of your poems off the page to make the audience greet them. Was this a part of what Larry Neal expressed when he said the movement radically opposed any concept of the artist that alienates him or her from their community?
Well, yeah, I would say that's part of it, too. But I was also referring to the fact that when I first heard Margaret Walker and Gwendolyn Brooks and Sterling Brown read their works, they read them well. Many of the poems have been memorized, but I also, the words, in a sense, stayed on the page. They were well-defined, well-written, brilliant poems. And then I began to remember my father's voice and all the musicians' voices, that when they spoke, their words leaped off the page, right? And went into some stratosphere and came back, and the music did the same thing. And that's what I wanted the words to do. I wanted the words to leap from the page. I wanted the words to greet the reader, you know, and then have a great hoedown, in a sense, you know, a great party, and then they would come back. The words would come back to me also too, and we would have had that kind of communion that could happen. And so therefore, I said in an essay someplace, so one of the things that we writers did, the writers sitting here on the stage, is that we began to write those words that said that indeed the world was not going to end with some kind of whisper, you know what I mean? But the world was alive and living, and our words would announce that the world was alive, and we were living in a place where our words would allow people to understand exactly what condition they were in, what they had been in, and what they could be in. So I wanted these words to celebrate us. So in response to the thing about Brother Larry, yeah, to celebrate our lives, that we are here, that this is no life that was going to be extinguished with a bang or a whisper. This is a life that's going to announce, we is here. I love that we is here. It is seditious. It's all get out, you know? And I said, yeah, I do teach English, but we is here, because no other way you can say that. And all the words that Brother Bullens and Brother Baraka did, and you, Brother Fuller, did announce that we is here. And we're going to be here. We've been here a long time. We're going to continue to be here. And also the words announced, too, in the sense that we're going to finally perhaps try to answer that question, what does it mean to be human? You know, that's what we're doing, you know, like we found all this grand inhumanity practiced against us, you know, as a people. And what we're going to do now is begin to say, you know, we is here, you know, we're not here to mess with you, but we're here to tell you that this is what has happened in the world. And we intend very much to continue to announce that we is here, and also at the same time to take this motion and movement to another place to answer this question, that if indeed you're walking upright and saying you're a human being, what does it mean to be human? Do you enslave? You know, do you kill? You know, do you, via your corporate greed, you know, don't pay workers enough? Do you, do your corporate greed, take your business across the seas and pay someone else some little, you know, mere pittance at some point? What does it mean to be human? When you look at me and see a different color, does that mean I am not your sister? You know, what does it mean to be human if you're in a classroom and you're teaching someone and someone says, you know, I don't get it? You say, well, good, I'll just give you an F and let you go on your merry way. And you don't then say, come to my office and let me go over this. What is it that you didn't get about this problem? You know, what is it that you didn't get about this essay? And you talk about it, give the information again, and then you say to that person, you can retake that exam. Because I want you to learn, not to fail. You know, and it's the same thing, I think, with our literature talked about, I don't want you to fail, I want you to learn, I want you to live, I want you to be. That's what this is truly all about. This is the kind of motion and movement that some of us were talking about in no uncertain terms. And I think that's why when we started to teach Black Studies at a place called San Francisco State, the FBI came to my house, you know, and my landlord knocked on the door and said, these men want to see you, Professor Sanchez. And the guy took out his badge and said, FBI. And I live right near Haight-Ashbury, so I figured some stuff was going down because something was always going down there. And I said, is there trouble? And he said, you're teaching Dubois, Garvey, Robeson, and another person, I'm blanking on it, Hughes. And I was so naive because, you know, I'm not a revisionist. I said, oh, yes, you cannot teach black literature without them. And the guy looked at me and went, duh, duh, duh. And, you know, he was, I mean, furious. He turned to my landlord and said, you should put her out. Put her out. She's one of those militants, not rap, militants on the campus. And I still didn't get it. You know, when you're in a foreign country and people don't understand you, so you say, my name is Sonia, right? You figure they'll get it, right? So I said, you know, yes, I teach black literature. I teach Du Bois, you know, whatever. And the guy's looking at me, and he put his hand, the other FBI guy stood still as dank water. He neither looked to the left or the right, just stood there. So my landlord said, oh, I'm leaving, I think, Professor Sanchez. You know, I don't think I'm needed here. And, you know, my Japanese-American neighbor had just given me a Samoyed, a most beautiful dog, right? And we were, like, dancing amongst each other because I come from New York City. We couldn't feed ourselves, much less a dog, you know? And so I had this dog for 1 week and barely spoke to the dog, moved around the dog. But I heard these big feet come down the hallway. And Snow sat down and looked up at the guy with his hand in my face. And the man said, you're teaching Dubois. And Snow leaped for the FBI man. And the guy said, lady, your dog. And I said, Snow? And Snow sat back down and kept looking at the FBI man. And I said to the guy, well, I guess I've told you all that I can tell you. And when they left, I went and petted the dog for the first time and said, you're in a house of vegetarians. I might buy your steak behind that. Okay. I'm saying all that to say simply that not only did we begin to write and get the words that would jump off the page to greet our greeters and our readers, and to greet the evening sky and the morning sun, not only did our words jump off the page to say, good morning, not good night, but good morning. Here we is. We're going to change this world because it is about changing this world, and our words will do that, will help change the world and people and present new ideas to everybody. That is the joy that it's been to be a writer, and they call you all kinds of names, but we do understand that we know and see who we are and who we have been.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. There isn't that much time for this sort of thing today. This is an hour. What I'm going to do is ask a single question of all three of our panelists and then open it up to the audience for questions. You three writers represent a radical change during the 60s and 70s. Can you give us some idea of what you see or what you feel is coming in the future, and are you optimistic about it?
You mean writing?
Yes, in terms of writing. And <what's happening. laughs> just to have nothing else. What do you expect?
Well, we're going to have to adjust to this new era. We've been strictly on attack. We've been, at least I have been, on attack mode, you know, whether it's Bush or Clinton, Bush, the other one or this one, you know. Plainclothes Nazis. We've been on the attack, but now we have to adjust and find out what is it that we can do in this new era. How can we help construct this new world? There's no such thing as a post-racist America, but we have to try to make that. So, you know, it's my view that as writers, we have to begin to try to construct this new world. We have to find out once, how can we get rid of racism? You know, if people think there's a post-racist syndrome, let them come and help make it true. You know, like Murdoch, for instance. Why isn't he in jail for putting that cartoon about Obama being shot like a monkey? No, I mean, we have to put these things out and make people think, you know. Second thing we have to do is get rid of this domination by these corporations over our lives, you know. My son's supposed to be giving out my newspaper that says, you know, President Obama, no bailout, nationalize the banks and the auto industry. Because there was a dude on television named, what was his name? Fuld from Lehman Brothers. And the congressman asked him, Mr. Fuld, I understand when Lehman Brothers failed, you walked away with $747 million. And he said, that's not accurate, Congressman. It was only $347 million. What I'm saying is the poets have to be in the world. It may be dangerous for you to be in the world, but like Encyclopedia Britannica says, the 100 greatest writers in the world. Not one of them is black.
That's right.
There's only one woman. She wrote the Catholic novels. I can't think of her name. Mm-hmm. But they said about Du Bois, the reason that he wasn't in there, he mentioned his name. Mm-hmm. Is that he kept wanting to talk about the world.
Yeah.
You know, not about the birds and the bees. You know, my wife says, well, the bourgeoisie owned the birds and the bees. But to talk about real life, you know, what's happening in the world. And I think that's what we're going to have to do. We have to adjust from just an attack mode, although I guess the Republican Party is trying on their white sheets. We might have to attack them. But we definitely have to find out how to help construct the new world, and I think that's what our poetry has to be. How do we create this world that Obama alluded to with a post-racist syndrome? How do we create that new world? How do we bring about the ideas that people need to complete the construction of a new world? That's what I think.
Thank you. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I agree with most of what you said, my dear brother. I don't think that we've always been in just an attack mode, you know? I think the very fact that we taught, you know, allowed us also to be in a different mode, you know? When you teach, and you teach students of all races, at some point you begin to understand you have to reconfigure, you know, what this stuff is really truly all about, what this literature is all about. And you can even teach and say things that you never even have to name stuff, like what it is. Like someone in class would say, that sounds like some kind of socialism, Professor Sanchez. I'd say, I didn't say that, you know. but the point is simply, at some particular point, you begin to understand, you must begin to look at what the world is about and what you want the world to be about, which means you engage students in some kind of activism, which means you have a course that you cannot teach a course without having your students going out into the community. You know, the students have to be in the community. They have to be about change. You also say to people, then I will accept one poem that talks about what someone did to you, but not a second or a third or fourth. This is not going to be a semester about what someone did to you. You know, you begin to talk about what it is possible. You give people 6 or 7 words, you know, and the words are going to be words for them to construct poems with the entire semester. And those words are loaded words. They're not just, and, you know, you're going to take those words and make poetry, you know, live and change. Because, you know, when Obama was elected, the earth did tilt. You know, and it means that you can't continue to write all that you used to write. The earth actually tilted, you know, on many levels. And it means that we've got to look up and say, what is it that I can write now to change the people around me? There are some people who will change, but most certainly directed and redirecting our words towards young people because, you know, this is their future. You know, this is their century. This 21st century belongs to young people. You know, and one of the things you want to say to them simply is that not only do you write poems, but also you go into the Congress. And when the Congress is not supporting a policy that Obama wants, then you go in and you start saying boo to the senators and to the congressmen. They will put you out, but you have another group coming in. I mean, the point is you've got to be active. You can't sit back and say he's going to do it himself. He's not going to do it himself, you know. And whenever Obama is wrong, I said to somebody, this is not a social event, his presidency, which means he can do no wrong. He's a human being. He's going to do something wrong, and we must then say, you're doing it wrong, and this is the way it's got to be. I mean, it is incumbent upon us to do that, but it's incumbent upon us also to teach our young people about being non-competitive when they write and being supportive with each other. I go to too many, slams. You know, they want you to judge them, and I do it, I sometimes yell. But I say to them before, I said, I can judge this, but you must listen to each other. You must not be backstage trying to figure out how you're going to best that person who just got all those claps before you, you know? You got to listen back and forth to each other, because the thing that I enjoyed a lot about us was that, and I think it still exists, that when we're on the stage, we listen to each other. And you pick up on the energy that Ed had before or Baraka had before, and you meet that energy and continue that energy for the audience benefit, you know? That's what we do. That's what we should be about, and that's what we should be doing. And is that kind of reality? Yeah. You know, we've got to challenge every bloody thing that is here. But I think we have to challenge it, you know, my thing, in a different way, with a lot of respect and peace, and the whole idea that peace must exist on this earth. Which means that, you know, no warlike things come out of my mouth today. I don't say, you know, to people, you know, if I get mad, you're, you know, MF, whatever. Because I can't, but it also means I can't watch a war movie. I can't let that enter this system, my body at all. It just doesn't enter, whatever. You know, I push it away. And in the same matter also, too, when I know someone's negative towards me, you have to push it away. Or I teach a lot of young people, I said, I want you to live, not die. Because this is a contract with life, not death. We got to have a contract with our children. And so I said, when we grew up in Harlem, we used our tongue to destroy people. You watch them fall out, you know, because that's what you learn. You're going to destroy you, so-and-so, whatever, et cetera. Now you don't do that, because the point is that it did not make for peace amongst people, and people didn't learn. They just got mad at each other. And so you have to teach some of the young people, sometimes you have to back away to have another day. You have to back away from the violence. Excuse me, I did not mean to offend you. Can you tell me what it is I can do, you know, to correct that offense? That's a hard thing to do. I come from New York City. And anyone who's read my early poetry, you know, I took no prisoners, you know. And even in talking to people, I took no prisoners. But now I've got to look at people and say, this whole idea of peace on this earth, you know, it's important to not only to us, the elders, but our children also, too, who must begin to deal with the climate and the philosophy of peace on this earth, and the idea of how we move, you know, as human beings. You've got to answer that question. If we don't, there will not be a 21st century. I don't care who's president. You know, I don't care, you know, what the Congress looks like. And we the people, we've got to remind the Congress and the president, it is about we the people. Not you, president. Not you, Congress. We the people. And if you don't act right, we will come to the Congress. We will stop the Congress and say, until you can do what you're supposed to do, we're going to sit here forever.
Mr. Bullen.
I'm going to paraphrase a comment by Brother Baraka. All their faces turned into the lights. And you work on them black arts magic. That's where the change comes in. And we are speaking freedom today. I remember I was shackled until I began writing, and I broke my shackles and became free in my mind. And so education and the freedom of writing, and I'm still writing as you have been told today, but I also teach. And I taught at the Black House in San Francisco with many of the cadre of revolutionaries there. And in the university system from the 1970s at Fordham through Northeastern University, where I still teach. And for the many, many theaters that I've worked at, and my new endeavor, the Roxbury Crossroads Theater, I'm going to dedicate and energize a section of it to teach the young people not only theater, but the modern technology of video, films, communication. And that with writing, with art, with music, will be my small contribution to this great, large world we are all stepping into. Thank you.
Okay, we are running very, very late. We can take a question from the audience. Yes, go ahead. They're going to bring a microphone to you.
Yeah, Brother Fuller, I'm aware of the fact that you had a play produced some years ago, Soldier's Story, at the NEC. You had a play produced at the NEC in New York some years ago, and the play has just recently been revived at the Signature Theater. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what you noted in terms of the changes that new views of theater might have instilled in the production, the new production.
No disrespect to you, but the truth is this panel is about them. It is about these three people who led a movement called the Black Arts Movement. And I really would like you to address your questions to the three of them, please. I can talk to you at length another time, but I really would like you to focus on these three people here who are, in my mind, very important in our history and for the arts in this country. Please, yes. Yeah, no, right here. Yes.
Oh, my question is, as like a up-and-coming, like, profound, like, poet now, I think I've been having, like, confidence problems, I guess, with the words, because I know that they're powerful, but I don't understand how to, like, really deliver the message. So I would like advice on how to, like, really, you know, deliver the message I'm trying to give out to people.
Whichever one of you wants to deal with that.
Well, one thing I think, and you know, coming off something Sonia said, the words on a page are a score. You know what I'm saying? Like if you can read Duke Ellington's music, if you can read the notes on a page, you can groove. You understand? But when it's played, then it becomes more dynamic. So that the question of actually learning to write poetry like you speak, they can say, get up, sit down. Not find some literary equivalent of that, but to actually, that's the most important thing, I think. Second thing I just want to mention, May 1st through 3rd at Temple University, there's a conference called 100 Days, where we're going to analyze Obama's first 100 days. May the 1st through the 3rd, get in touch with Muhammad Ahmed, you know, Max Stanford, at Temple University Black Studies.
One more question and that's it. Yes. Who has the microphone on that side of the room?
I need the microphone.
Can't hear.
You need it for me. I saw
the article in the news article about the presence of the panel here, of the people on the panel, and I saw the word and the word radical. And, you know, radical is sharp. It makes your blood rise. It do all kinds of threatening things. So I heard Sonia when she said that when we start moving toward that level where we become human beings, where we're no longer labels, where you do what's right because it's the human cord, it's the human consciousness. So I'm sitting here thinking, so when do you all at the panel, when are you no longer radicals? When do they come up with a term for you that lets the world know that you are human beings? So, and I'm sure you've had that kind of language and lingo, I mean, all this time about being called a radical. Just respond to that name as opposed to being a human being, or there are going to be poets there. So is that name supposed to automatically...
You have to be radical to insist on humanity in a place where they insist on you being an animal.
Okay, all right, okay.
Okay, I'm going to have to say good afternoon.
Tutanana.
I'm happy all of you came, but I've been told we must stop this. Thank you very, very much for coming out.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.